Support for Alaska Public Media On Demand comes from People Mover. Help update the public transit service plan. Visit transitonthemove.com to take the latest public survey by April 26th.
The following program contains content that might not be suitable for all listeners.
Good morning, Alaska, and welcome to Line One, your health connection on Alaska Public Media. I am your host, Prentice Pemberton. With the Jeffrey Epstein saga leading the way, stories about child sexual abuse and maltreatment are far too common of a theme in our society and throughout the world. The statistics are alarming. It's estimated that 1 in 4 girls and 1 in 8 boys in the U.S. will be sexually abused before the age of 18. The economic costs of child abuse are estimated to be $9.3 billion per year in the U.S., and that pales in comparison to the human cost. Abused children suffer disproportionately from mental, physical, and social challenges throughout their lifetimes, and often pass this trauma on to the next generation. We know much of this thanks to today's guest, Dr. Frank Putnam. Dr. Putnam pioneered the Female Growth and Development Study, which is the largest and longest lasting study of female sexual abuse ever conducted. Dr. Putnam is a professor of clinical psychiatry at the University of North Carolina School of Medicine and an emeritus professor of pediatrics and child psychiatry at Children's Hospital Medical Center at the University of Cincinnati College of Medicine. Welcome to the program, Dr. Putnam. I appreciate you taking the time to join me today.
Thank you very much for having me. Appreciate the opportunity to talk to Alaskans.
Yeah, it's a pleasure having you from snowy Virginia.
Yeah, for once in a couple of years.
Yeah. I keep stumbling on your last name because we had when I was a teenager, our family saw a therapist named Frank Pittman. And so I keep mixing that up in my brain.
Okay, well, you do better than many people call me Putman. I'm Putnam.
It's Putnam, yes. I will get that right. Okay, I need to take a second to let listeners know that today's conversation is pre-recorded and we cannot take any phone calls or emails today. All right, let's start off by having you share with us a little bit about your background and what led you to devoting your life to the study of sexual and maltreatment of children, sexual abuse and maltreatment of children, and the advocating for abused children.
I was, I sort of got my first introduction to trauma working with Vietnam veterans in the middle to late 70s. And then I went to the National Institute of Mental Health to do a research fellowship. And I began working with a very unusual disorder there called, now called dissociative identity disorder. Many people know it as multiple personality disorder. And all of the subjects and patients that I worked with told me that they had been this way since childhood, that they had always been multiple. So I thought that if I found children, it might be easier to understand what was the going on with the illness. And also, it might be more convincing for many people who are skeptical of the diagnosis. So I began seeing children. I created a profile that I circulated among foster parents, among adoptive parents, child protective agencies, around therapists who worked with children, and asked to see children who showed a variety of different problems but were extremely behaviorally disturbed. And I saw a fair number of children and realized that while many of them were not dissociative identity disorder, the common theme that they all shared was that they were sexually abused. And I realized not only was that very devastating in terms of their behavior, but also I was seeing what I felt were biological changes in them. And that the only way to understand the impact of this was, in fact, to study them prospectively forward. So with my collaborator, the late Dr. Penny Trickett, we began a study in 1987, which followed roughly 100 sexually abused girls ages 6 to 15 and a matched comparison group forward in time. And we've been following them for more than 35 years. They're now in their really late 40s and early 50s at this time. And we've seen them 8 separate times for very intensive evaluations. And that's what we refer to as the Female Growth and Development Study. We've looked at the impact across all of these different ages of having been sexually abused. And this was sexual abuse within a family context. This is actually the most common form of sexual abuse for females in the United States, for girls in the United States, is to be abused within the context of their family, whereas boys are often abused outside of the home by coaches or leaders of some sort. So we followed them now, and then we saw their children at our time 6 evaluation. We saw all the children born to our original children. And from the first time 1, 2, and 3, since they were minors, their mothers came in, and so we saw their mothers. So we have 3 generations that we've collected data on, looking at the biological impact, the psychological impact, the social impact, the cognitive impacts of child sexual abuse over the lifespan.
All right, so that's amazing that you got to see multiple generations of children and young women who had their own kids, and you got a wealth of information from that. So the Female Growth and Development Study, what did it help you really understand about the impacts of child maltreatment, in particular sexual abuse? Like, you know, I do want to get back to the DID thing briefly, but can you answer that part first?
Certainly. We were interested in how it affected their development. So we chose a number of processes to follow that were developmental, and these included puberty. So we were interested in how, when they started puberty, how soon they passed through puberty. We looked at the maturation of stress response systems like the hypothalamic pituitary adrenal axis. We looked at their cognitive development with a series of IQ tests over time. We looked at issues around the autoimmune, accumulating autoimmune sort of markers, because one of the things that we'd seen clinically was that many of them had autoimmune diseases as adults. That's what one of the things I had noticed, and we wanted to follow that. We followed their height and weight and their body mass index, among other things. So we were interested in what those curves looked like, how well they developed, how fast they developed. And the common thing that we found across all of this that was really was the fact that they essentially were aging faster. They were moving through puberty faster. Their stress response systems were maturing faster, but also essentially weakening faster. They were accumulating autoimmune problems faster. Their cognitive was basically topping out sooner, and they were starting cognitive declines faster. So everywhere we were looking, we were seeing essentially accelerated aging in them. And this makes a lot of sense when we look at some of the outcomes, particularly medically, that are associated with aging. Essentially, they're prone to many diseases for which aging is the largest risk factor, things like heart disease and cancers and dementias, those sorts of things.
Okay, if you are just tuning in late today, my guest is child psychiatrist Dr. Frank Putnam. Today we are discussing his new book, Old Before Their Time, which is the culmination of his 40-plus years of scientific study into the impacts of child sexual abuse and maltreatment. Please note that today's program is pre-recorded, so we will not be able to accept phone calls or emails. All right, Dr. Putman, I wanted to circle back briefly about dissociative identity disorder, and there seems to be a strong correlation between that particular disorder and, I mean, that disorder has a lot of, controversy surrounding it, and a lot of people still don't believe in it, but there's a big, a link between long-term early childhood sexual abuse and DID. Is that one of the things that you found?
Yes, that's correct. And pretty much everybody who's looked has found that. There's a clear relationship between early childhood trauma and the development of a dissociative identity disorder. And even if you don't develop dissociative identity disorder, people with histories of early childhood trauma have increased rates of dissociation in general, which is a process you can think of like depression or anxiety, something that we can measure pretty well. And so not everybody develops altered personalities as a result of this, but many of the people who have these tragic experiences are more dissociative, which is still interfering with their lives. It seems to be one of the outcomes of particularly early abuse. It seems like that the dissociation is not, often there's a kind of a myth that these traumatic experiences sort of blow people apart. They explode the personality into little fragments. But that's not what we found. What we really found was that the trauma interferes with the consolidation and integration of different mental states that children have. Children are fairly sort of normally dissociative. And they basically craft more of a unified personality over time, often with the help of caretakers who help them understand how to behave in different contexts and how to generalize memory and information from one place to another. And these children were deprived of that, and therefore they grew up with sort of more separate identity states that they switch back and forth between.
That's really interesting because I think about the child mind and its imagination, right, and its ability to create, these different worlds. And it seems like there's some mechanism that is, they take, it's very protective at its essence, is to take on these different parts that it's almost like they can set up a situation where it's not really happening to them.
That's exactly right. If you think about children's play, just normal children's play, it has a lot of identity components in it. They like to dress up. They like to play different parts.
Right.
They play with dolls or action figures, and they infuse them with personality. So there's a kind of a tendency to do that natural tendency to do that in children. And this seems to be working with that as a defense mechanism. If it happens to this other part of me that I call George or whatever, it's not happening to me. It's a way of, to some extent, preserving part of themselves that's not abused or is able to accept whatever nurturance or support that they're getting out of their home life situation.
All right. One of the most interesting things that in the early part of the book and throughout the book was really this sort of resistance that you ran into with agencies and higher ups in these agencies and to get money for your research. You ran into a lot of resistance around some of your ideas about the impacts of sexual abuse. And can you talk about why you think that was?
Yes, and I it's not unique to us. Pretty much everybody I know who works in this field has really struggled to find support, to find funding, to find people who think it's a worthy a scientific problem even. Many times during my work, I was told this was not scientific. This was really a social problem and not a scientific problem. even though we were finding some very profound biological changes in these children. I think there's a variety of reasons. For about a dozen years, I also ran a center that evaluated maltreated children, and I worked a lot in the community. And when I talked about child abuse in the community, there was a group of people that was just, they could not conceive that these things were done to children. So
right.
There's, I think, some people who just say, who would ever do that to a child? I just don't believe that. But there's also a more malicious or a darker form of pushback, it seemed to me, that we had at multiple places over the period of working there, where we had funding cuts, where we had resources withdrawn, where we were basically shut down at various times, where we were able to sort of finesse that and move the study to other institutions when the institution we were at felt that the study wasn't something that they wanted to support. I think you see that in a lot of ways. You mentioned the Epstein files at the beginning here, and this is certainly something you're seeing right now going on. There's a unwillingness to really acknowledge and release things like the Epstein files. Survivors face a lot of pushback, a lot of harassment and threats. These are secrets that often there are forces in our society that don't simply want to acknowledge.
Yeah, that gets into a lot of the conspiracy stuff, but it doesn't seem like it's a conspiracy. It seems like it's something that people don't want to accept. It's too ugly to look at. There's powerful people involved. I mean, the Catholic Church scandal was one that, keep just moving priests around. Sandusky, the years that he was able to harm young people people see it and do they not want to believe it? It doesn't compute. They're afraid. What's the stop? Because it's obviously something that nobody or most people would not think is okay.
Well, that's the paradox, isn't it? That most people would condemn this. And at
yeah.
the same time, we don't get the sort of support that you would think that we would get. And that the programs that we have that are prevention programs that have been proven to work don't get funded in the kind of scale that makes any difference. They may be funded as pilot projects, but this is a very common, as you mentioned at the beginning, 1 in 4, 1 in 5 women, for example, and that should be, we should have universal child abuse prevention programs and child sexual abuse prevention programs across the country, and yet they often are just put out as pilot programs. They often are shown to work, and yet they never taken to that next step. So there is, you have to, if you work in this field, you really feel like there are people who don't want to see this pursued.
Yeah, it's almost a lot of times too ugly to look at, or people are, some of the offenders are held in high regard in the community. I think of Boy Scout leaders and teachers and priests, and people just don't want to believe that it could happen in their home or in their community. And it seems like a problem that I think more education and more advocacy and awareness would help, because it happens anywhere. I mean, the most dangerous, one of the things that you brought up is the stepfather frequency. I mean, what are the numbers on biological father incest versus stepfather incest?
So this is something that we really took a pretty good close look at. What were some of the factors that made the abuse more traumatic, and how did the different sort of perpetrator groups look? We were working only with women. We actually are actually girls at the beginning, and now they're women. Many of them are actually grandmothers at this point. We were looking at familial abuse situations. So this was occurring in the family, and this is the most common form for girls. For boys, the most common form is actually outside of the family, as you mentioned, the religious leaders, the Boy Scout leaders, the coaches. Are more, and so these are actually fairly different experiences as what, as far as we can tell in terms of their impact. But one of the things that makes the familial piece so difficult is that these people who, the perpetrators, the stepfathers, the live-in boyfriends, the biological fathers, other relatives, they're parts of the family. They're right. Members of the family. And so people don't want to talk about this because it impacts their reputation of their family. It impacts people they know, and in many cases often have strong positive feelings for also. So it's very confusing, particularly for younger children, you know, that they may really enjoy being with grandpa, but grandpa does this thing also to them. And so it's got that family secret shame also that keeps it hidden.
Yeah. All right. We're going to get back to a little bit more about that, but we're at our first break. For those of you who might be tuning in late, my guest today is child psychiatrist Dr. Frank Putnam. Today we are discussing his new book, Old Before Their Time, which is the culmination of his 40 plus years of scientific study into the mental, physical, and societal impacts of child sexual abuse and maltreatment. Today's program is pre-recorded, so we will not be able to accept phone calls or emails. After a short break, we'll return for more of our conversation with Dr. Frank Putnam. I'm Prentice Pemberton, and you're listening to Line One, Your Health Connection on Alaska Public Media.
Hi, I'm Avery Elfelt, a reporter with the Alaska Desk. That's a joint reporting effort from Alaska Public Media, KHNS, where I work in Haines, and other public radio stations in Anchorage, Fairbanks, and the Aleutians. It allows us to connect you with the issues happening in communities all across the state. You can hear our stories during the morning news on Alaska News Nightly or online at alaskapublic.org. The Alaska Desk is only possible with the support of grants and listeners like you. Thank you.
The following program contains content that might not be suitable for all listeners.
Welcome back to Line One, Your Health Connection on Alaska Public Media. I am your host, Prentice Pemberton. If you are just joining us, my guest today is child psychiatrist Dr. Frank Putnam. We are discussing his new book, Old Before Their Time, which is the culmination of his 40 plus years of scientific study into the mental, physical, and societal impacts of child sexual abuse and maltreatment. Quick reminder, today's program is pre-recorded, so we cannot accept phone calls or emails. All right, Dr. Putnam, before the break, we were discussing family incest and the secrets, and you mentioned that it's the most devastating kind for a lot of the reasons. Like, I have worked in this field of psychology for, how old am I? 30 plus years now, and when people reveal this, it is incredibly powerful. Sometimes the perpetrators have committed suicide. Kids are not believed. Mothers don't believe them. Relatives, it blows up families. It's not an easy thing to disclose. And I mean, why? What's the argument for disclosure? I mean, what is the it's been held in family secrets. My own family has some history of this way back, and it's something that nobody talked about, even though everybody knew. But what's the damage that comes from non-disclosure and not dealing with it?
Well, that's really a very good question. And the answer, I think, is that it gets perpetuated. And it gets often perpetuated across generations. And there are often also more victims as a result of it not being brought to light sooner. But you're quite correct about, I mean, the shame, the unwillingness to sort of finger family members. All those things work against revealing these family secrets. And as you indicated, when they do come out, it's often extremely emotional for these individuals. And they're often rejected by family who disbelieve it. They say, he would never have done those things to you. You're just making that all up. So often people keep it quiet. And this is, I think, where in many ways, say, the Epstein victims are different than the average girl who's molested within the family, which is that they all shared a common abuser outside of the family. And so there was the fact that they all had similar experiences and that this was not somebody who was a family member. We found that the closer the relationship between the perpetrator and the victim, the more devastating it was in general.
So it is in fact on a continuum. If there is if it's an isolated event for a child at 10 or 11, it's different, significantly different than systematic abuse from, say 4 to 12 by a close family member.
Yeah, that's absolutely correct. And when people think about maltreatment or sexual abuse, they often sort of think about it as occurring once or twice. But the average girl in our study was abused over 2 years at a frequency of once or twice a week. So you're talking about several hundred episodes of molestation. And many of them, this went on for 4, 5, 6 or more years. So you're talking about hundreds of experiences, not simply once or twice. Again, also the earlier it happened, the earlier the onset was, the longer the duration, and the sort of the more force and coercion were also elements that made the outcomes worse.
Yeah, and you brought up a different thing, one point in the book, which I've noticed in folks that I've worked with over the years, is that there's often when it occurs younger, and then they come to realize, or it's disclosed, and then they realize that it's something bad, there's a lot of internal shame, because often it was something that the child, maybe felt good about or okay. It was a special time. It was a special secret, right? It was something that often sometimes came with comfort and attention. And so that creates a real disconnect mentally for young people as they realize that everyone thinks it's this horrific thing, which it is, but that they have these positive associations with it sometimes. Is that accurate?
That's very accurate. That's one of the things that's very confusing for young children, particularly as they begin to realize that this is not appropriate. But early on, they may experience it as a special relationship, and often they're sort of told it's a special
right.
relationship. And then they discover that that was not the case, and that is also very devastating, that they've been betrayed in that sense.
Yeah, that's got to be super confusing for a 12-year-old or anybody as they come into awareness of what this actually means to them. Okay, I think the next thing I want to kind of jump into is this, get a little bit more, you've mentioned it a couple of times, but this idea of biological aging and the impacts, the cortisol levels, that was something interesting in the book, that the cortisol levels and some of the stress hormones were highly elevated in kids, which is different than what you see in adult PTSD, people who are suffering from PTSD as adults. Can you talk a little bit about that phenomenon?
Yes, we were very interested in studying the stress response system. We thought this would be one of the systems that would be highly impacted by these experiences. And this is a system, the what we call the HPA axis, the hypothalamic pituitary adrenal axis, which basically activates your adrenal glands under stress, and the adrenal glands produce a hormone, a cortisol, which many people have heard of, but also adrenaline. This takes a while to come online. You're not born with fully functioning adrenal glands or fully functioning HPA axis. It comes online about age six, and then your puberty can start after that, but you can't sort of start puberty until your HPA axis is fully developed. What we found in studying that was that the caused an abnormal development of the HPA axis, so that early on the maltreated girls had much higher levels of cortisol and adrenaline, and that about age 18 that became lower than our comparison girls, so that they went from being significantly higher to significantly lower. And that transition between high and low was related, we found, to basically metabolism changes in them, so that they began to gain weight much faster than our comparison girls gained weight. And this is something that had been noticed in a retrospective way, that many maltreatment and sexual abuse victims had issues with weight gain and obesity. And this was a finding that occurred in a number of weight loss programs, so notably by the Vincent Folletti and the ACEs group, the Adverse Childhood Experiences group. So that we found that this was changing their metabolism and leading them to gain weight much faster, so that by age 18 years, our average maltreated girl was heavier than 75% of 18-year-old girls in the U.S.
And it just continued to ramp up from there as far as the discrepancy.
That's correct. And the next thing it seemed to affect was, in fact, this biological aging as measured by looking at the epigenetic changes in their DNA.
It's just fascinating, the amount of research now and the information that you have learned from this. This book is it's deep in research, and it's got lots of scientific stuff in it and stories. Like, who would benefit from reading this book? I certainly did as a therapist. It's not, I think, for your average reader who wants to read a novel or something. But who was the target audience for this book, and who would benefit from reading it besides therapists?
Well, I think in general medical professionals would benefit from reading it, because it says that it's not all in your head, that it in fact profoundly affects your body development. And this is certainly something that I would hear from victims when I would present the results often, was that I had validated for them something they felt that they intrinsically knew, which is that these experiences had changed their body. I think that there are implications both for the incorporation of this into both therapy and also thinking about really medical illnesses. These individuals who have histories of maltreatment have much higher rates of chronic diseases, but typically things like heart disease and dementia and cardiovascular problems, stroke, cancers. And there's, well, fairly good documentation that this actually is shortens the lifespan. And that this is one of the things that should be part of the history that every physician takes of patients, particularly if they are presenting early on in there with something that we normally associate with an older person in terms of the onset of essentially premature onset of some of the chronic diseases and leading causes of death in this country. The positive thing about that is that we can look at the epigenetic piece, the DNA changes, which are changes not in the coding of the DNA, but changes sort of in the structure of the DNA that impact whether that DNA is expressed or not. And in particular, we're looking at a change called methylation that leads the DNA to change the expression of the DNA. Some of those things we know to be reversible. So now we would have a marker, presumably, of which treatments seem to reverse some of these processes. So we might have really a better marker to chase in terms of developing better treatments.
Yeah, the early intervention, can you talk a little bit about why? I mean, you seem to just allude to it, but that early intervention, why is that so critical in helping young people? And we're not talking about just sexual abuse. We're talking about physical abuse and long-term emotional abuse. That's considered under this umbrella of child maltreatment. Is that correct?
That's correct. That's correct. Now, we focused on child sexual abuse, but about half our sample also had histories of physical abuse, which we would control for. So what we've known for a while that sort of the earlier the intervention, the better the child is going to do on average. And so it becomes very important to recognize this early and to intervene early. And these children, and because we're talking about what we would call a trajectory, the sense the person is on a course,
right.
And if we can intervene early, we can change the course. If the longer it goes on, the harder it becomes to change that trajectory. So we do see that when children are put in secure, safe places and they're protected, a lot of the early stuff that we see, the problems, the behavioral problems, go away. There's also some evidence the biology gets better, though we don't have as much good data on the biological recovery. But we certainly do see improvements in the behavior, and those are things that make life a lot easier if they're not having trouble, behavioral problems. Because what we also saw was that these girls had a great deal of difficulty in school, for example. They were seen as suffering from ADHD. They had problems with attention. Most of them dropped out of school around the 11th grade. Many of them were pregnant when they dropped out of school, so that there was early teenage pregnancy in many of them. We also found, for example, that they were more than twice as likely to have a premature baby when they were pregnant. So that's a costly and a very difficult thing. To have a preemie, particularly your first one.
Yeah, that goes into the, I mean, you make the argument that this is perhaps, you know, fixing this scourge of, you know, child maltreatment and sexual abuse is perhaps the single most impactful thing we could do as far as for the mental, physical health of our society as a whole, right?
Yes, exactly. Because we do have prevention programs at work, and because this touches so many areas of the individual in terms of their mental health, it's certainly associated with more depression, more dissociation, more aggression, more, certainly much higher rates of substance abuse in child abuse victims. It crosses generations so that the impacts, even if there's not an abuse in the next generation, having a parent who is depressed or has PTSD or high levels of dissociation or is a substance abuser is also impacts the next generation. So this is something that would not only help individuals, but it crosses generations and could interventions here could actually be protective of future generations. So I do make the argument this is a single best target for prevention, both of mental health problems, but also of earlier medical problems and social problems.
Yeah, it seems like the ripple effects would be far and wide. It would touch medical, mental health. It would touch educational systems. It would save money in so many different areas of our society.
Yes. That's exactly my argument.
Okay, I do want to ask about an interesting phenomenon that you found, the re-victimization of folks who undergo early childhood trauma. But we're going to go ahead and take our second break just about a minute early because I don't want to get into that and then cut you off. So for those of you who might be tuning in late, my guest today is child psychiatrist Dr. Frank Putnam. Today we're discussing his new book, Old Before Their Time, which is the culmination of his 40-plus years of scientific study into the mental, physical, and societal impacts of sexual abuse and child maltreatment. Quick reminder, today's program is pre-recorded. We cannot accept phone calls or emails. After a quick break, we'll continue with more of our conversation with Dr. Frank Putnam. I'm Prentice Pemberton, and this is Line 1, your health connection on Alaska Public Media.
The PFD application is open. Just a small amount of your PFD will help share local news and stories about Alaskans with Alaskans across this great state when you choose Alaska Public Media through Pick, Click, Give.
The following program contains content that might not be suitable for all listeners.
Welcome back to Line 1, your health connection on Alaska Public Media. I am your host, Prentice Pemberton. For those of you who might be tuning in late, my guest today is child psychiatrist Dr. Frank Putnam. Today we are discussing his new book, Old Before Their Time, which is the culmination of his 40-plus years of scientific study into the mental, physical, and societal impacts of child sexual abuse and maltreatment. Today's program is pre-recorded, and we cannot accept phone calls. All right, Dr. Putnam, before the break, I brought up this idea of re-victimization, and it seems, you know, I've seen this anecdotally in my own practice that folks who were abused as children tend to have a pattern or an increased likelihood of later in life, or, you know, young adults, teenagers, and then into adulthood of being re-victimized. What is that? How do you explain that?
So this observation, which you've made and many other people have made also, is something that's been established pretty well scientifically, that victims of child sexual abuse in particular are more likely to be re-victimized by others not in the family, for example, about 2 to 3-fold more. And in our sample, we looked at this twice, and both times, so it's about 2.5 times more likely to be re-victimized by strangers than our comparison girls. And this revictimization, of course, trauma is cumulative, and so this revictimization adds to that trauma load that individuals. So what were the mechanisms that might be explanatory for this? Well, there seemed to be two things that we saw in our study that we thought were contributory to these higher rates of revictimization. One was a set of behaviors that we created a scenario we called the strange man, in which we wanted to look at the response of the maltreated girls and the comparison girls to an unfamiliar male who was a psychologist who was doing a psychological testing on them. And so we videotaped this, and then it was coded by people who were blind to whether or not this child was abused, as was the psychologist who they interacted with. And we were looking at a number of things we gleaned out of the anthropological literature that had to do with essentially courtship, having to do with sending signals that are, we'd say, come hither or keep your distance, body language. And we found that the maltreated girls basically were exhibited more things that people might see as provocative kinds of behavior or sexualized behavior. What we could see by examining these very carefully with the videos was that these were not sexual advances. They were really more what we might call social icebreakers. But they were basically these, many of the abused girls sort of had more forward kinds of behaviors towards this psychologist who was scripted to act in a very neutral fashion. So that was one contributing factor, which we think is amenable to basically helping them learn other behaviors in these kinds of contexts. The other one was dissociation, that is the tendency to sort of space out. And that seems to affect vigilance. Mm-hmm. And there's a number of studies that basically show that if you create an artificial situation with individuals who've been victimized and then say, okay, does this look like it's becoming dangerous? And you sort of take them through a series of steps and they're supposed to say when they think this is becoming a dangerous relationship or something. We find that individuals who've been abused are slower to recognize this, which is paradoxical. You would think that they would be recognize this faster, but actually this has been a pretty systematic finding in a number of different studies, that they seem to have lower vigilance. And this is also associated with this intergenerational transmission, particularly in impacting the mothers who were sexually abused themselves. They seem to be less able to recognize when their children are vulnerable. Huh. So oftentimes this intergenerational transmission of risk is not so much that the parent who was abused, particularly the mother who was abused, is abusing. It's that they become associated with a perpetrator and they don't recognize that this is happening to their children.
That's really interesting, because as you mentioned, you would think that would be the opposite would occur, that people who were victimized would be hypervigilant, right, and look for those signs. But you're saying they're sort of desensitized or somehow don't recognize them as much.
That seems to be what's happening, is that this vigilance that they need to have both to protect themselves and also to protect their own children later is somehow they're not able to spot this as well. And so essentially they get into these situations more easily, or they don't recognize when the danger signs or the red flags as soon as individuals haven't had these experiences. So it is sort of a blinding situation. And again, this is something that could presumably be addressed more specifically.
All right, we got about 9 minutes left, and I got a lot. I could probably talk to you for another hour. This is a fascinating conversation. But I do want to touch on the difference between girls and boys who go through sexual abuse and they grow up. Like, is there a different outcome for adults in these two groups?
Yes, we didn't. In our study, we didn't study males because we never could get funding to do that.
Right.
Even though we tried multiple times to interest people. But males, as I mentioned earlier, are often abused in a different context. It's somebody outside the family, often a trusted person, or maybe a family friend, but also coach or a scout leader or a religious leader, for example. They aren't abused as frequently. As the girls who maybe have hundreds and hundreds of episodes. But the outcomes are, they share certain things such as the depression outcomes and anxiety, but the males have more aggression. There's also, to be honest about it, there's also an increased risk of perpetration by males who've been abused themselves. That's one of the things that sort of differentiates them from the females, who are less likely to become perpetrators. But one of the tragic outcomes for the males is that they're higher rate of sexual offending.
I read an interesting, it was a quote somewhere that said that not all sexual abuse, or not all perpetrators were sexually abused, but I forget how it went now that I'm trying to think of it, but not everybody who is sexually abused will become a perpetrator, but almost all perpetrators were sexually abused. That's what it was.
Okay, well, let me put some numbers on that, because this is something that I'm quite interested in understanding, the intergenerational transmission. The first thing I think I try to tell people about this is that most people who were sexually abused in childhood do not become perpetrators. Right. And the number is probably about 70%, as best we can tell, do not become sexual. So you're more likely not to pass this on. But about 30% do have children that are either victims, in that case they may be mothers who are not vigilant and their children are perpetrated, or maybe they're perpetrators themselves. And that 30% is about six times higher than what you might call the spontaneous rate. And that is, for parents who were not abused, how often are they likely to sexually abuse their children? So that's about a fifth or a sixth of times. Let me reframe that a little bit. But they're six times more likely to maltreat their children or sexually abused child than somebody who didn't have that experience. But most of the people who were abused as children do not become abusers.
All right. One thing I do want to get to real quick, I think this book is also good for policymakers and people who are in the child protective services business, which is a very difficult job and is thankless and hard on people to do and is often understaffed and underfunded. So can you talk a little bit about how we could improve the protection of children in our country? It's a big question, but
yeah, it's a big question. And I think the first thing people should understand is that most child protection operates at a county level. And so there may be some state oversight, but most counties are sort of unto themselves to some extent to decide how to investigate these cases and what kinds of decisions they make. So there's a lot of variability there. There are real significant efforts to try to standardize this and improve this, to create a better system for making sure the evaluations are done fairly and also thoroughly. There are also a number of programs that are designed to make this easier for the family. As we talked about earlier, this is really, it blows up families. This is very painful. This is very destructive in some ways for the family. And so there are programs such as differential response, or sometimes called alternative response, that is meant to be less stigmatizing for families. And also there are child advocacy centers, which I directed one for 12 years, that basically pull together all the different components, the child protective service workers, but also the doctors, the nurses, the prosecutor, the police, and also often victim advocates, all work together as a separate team. So you have a much higher level of coordination. Cases are handled in a much more expedient way for the families. And the effort is to make them as least traumatic as possible, to go through sometimes the examinations and the multiple interviews. We attempt to decrease those as much as possible, and to get the child into treatment and family and the services as quickly as possible.
All right, so less fragmentation, more uniformity, really a standard of care and intervention across the country that is evidence-based would be a better approach.
Yes. I think we also need better national statistics. We really don't have really good statistics on this, which is why we get such large swings in the numbers of kids that are reportedly abused. We have kind of the official child protection system, but then there are a lot of cases that are never seen in that system. but are nonetheless are victimized also. So we need a more comprehensive system. We need to be collecting better data on this. We need to make it a more supportive system, particularly for the families and the non-abusing members of the family, as well as the victims.
Yeah, one of the biggest problems is the stigma, as with most mental health stuff, is the stigma of this. But can you talk briefly about some of the protective factors for kids who disclose and come out? I thought it was really interesting, the information about how that disclosure is received, and especially by mothers.
Yes, mothers are the most common person that the children disclose to, specifically the girls. And so the support of the mother and whether the mother believes the child or not is very important in terms of how well the child does and ultimately how well the family does. We really feel that support of the mothers, we put a lot of money into the rehabilitation of perpetrators and the services for the children, but the mothers are often the ones who are also seriously impacted. Many of them have their own abuse experiences, and now their children have been abused, and we found that supporting the mothers, the better the mothers do, the better the children do in general. So one of the soapboxes I stand on is we need to support non-abusing parents and mothers better because they can do more for their children than generally therapists and the system can.
Right. And that's critical because so often when this is disclosed, maybe the perpetrator is the primary breadwinner and he's gone. And then mother doesn't have the money or the resources and they're really left sort of in a worse situation financially and support-wise than when before the disclosure.
Right. And often they haven't been allowed to do anything. They've been the perpetrator has been very controlling, so they don't have the skills to they don't know how to run a checkbook or whatever. And so often they need a lot of just basic support in those areas.
All right. Real quick, what should someone do? Well, I don't know if they have experienced this and want to get some help.
Well, we do have effective treatments. Most of those are right now along the cognitive behavioral therapy spectrum that they help in about 70% of the cases. I don't think you ever undo this or make this go away, but many people can move beyond it. Mm. And it's also very important to get treatment because that really helps the family.
All right.
Move off.
My thanks to today's guest, Dr. Frank Putnam, for taking the time to join us for this important topic. My thanks also to Line One producer Tobin Shelby and today's audio engineer, Crystal Hyde. For all of us at Line One, thanks to all of you for taking the time to be with us today. Till next time, I'm Prentice Pemberton. Have a great day, Alaska.
Line One is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the host and participants and not necessarily those of Alaska Public Media, this station, or its underwriters. Learn more about Line One and listen online at alaskapublic.org. This is Alaska Public Media.